District 48, Happy Valley, Southeast Portland. I'm one of the sponsors of House Bill 2555. And what I'm trying to do here, and what we're trying to do here, is get stable funding for Oregon Public Defendants to make sure we have money to keep folks in their homes rather than in foster care or nursing home, and just continue their quality of life. Put a stable funding mechanism here so it doesn't continue to be a political football every 2 years when it's nice people come down here. Jacqueline Zimmer requested that I submit this. I don't claim to be an expert on this subject matter. I do hope to be a senior citizen someday, and hope that my community, if I need the help, takes care of me as well. I'm just going to leave it to that. The technicalities I'm going to leave to these smart gentlemen next to me.
Thank you, members of the committee, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Steve March. I represent House District 46 in the center of Portland. I'm also a gerontologist, and I've taught gerontology courses at Portland State. I have long been interested in Oregon Project Independence and trying to secure stable funding. Both bills are good bills. The funding source that we're trying to secure is the interest on the monies paid back into the Oregon Senior Property Tax Deferral Program. It's in the basically excess interest only. Over the last few decades, we've taken and put that money into the general fund. Both bills would direct that money into an Oregon Project Independence Fund. The difference between the two bills, essentially, is House Bill 2626, sponsored by Representative Jensen and myself, accepts Oregon Project Independence in its current form and targets the money for the existing program. Representative Schaffler's bill, it takes Oregon Project Independence and modernizes it to include persons with disabilities. And so the question comes down to, we think it's a great concept, use the nexus of the senior property tax deferral interest money going for seniors to keep them in their homes. It's a really tight connection there. So the real question is, do you want to modernize OPI at this time? And if so, you go with the Representative Schaffler's bill, and I would be happy to sign on to his. If you decide we can't do the modernization at this particular time, and although it's a great idea, then you go with Representative Jensen and my bill. And that's the essence of it, and I'll turn it over to Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Representative March.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity to be here to speak to you this morning for a moment on these bills. For the record, I am Bob Jensen, State Representative from House District 58, and unlike my distinguished colleague from the metro area, this is not a matter of I hope to be a senior citizen someday. This, however, is a program that I have a long-standing history in this chamber of supporting. My first session here, I brought a bill to refund funding of OPI to a previous level, and it seems like, in spite of what I think is the tremendous merits of this program, OPI, it is necessary, it has been necessary, to come back before the legislature every session and seek refunding or additional funding for it. OPI has been around in the state of Oregon since the days of when Ron Wyden now United States Senator, was a staffer in this building. And as many people remember or will remember, that senior citizens were certainly, as Senator Wyden began his political career, were very much a part of his base and worked very hard for it. But the program, Oregon Project Independence, was expanded not in the state of Oregon, but across the nation as a model program. One of those, if you wish, win-win types of situations, a situation that provided vital and needed services for senior citizens in our society, and at the same time, it should be unconstitutional, but at the same time save money. I mean, this is not something government is supposed to do, to provide good services and save money at the same time. But this is precisely what OPI does, and it has always been a real concern to me that a program that with this kind of merit has to struggle every time that the legislature meets in the state that started it, and for a program that has become a national model since that time. That's a just kind of a brief history of, you know, where I am. I would echo the comments of my good friend and colleague from Portland as far as the two bills, the difference between Representative Schaffler's bill and Representative Marks's and my bill, and I think I'm already signed on to Representative Schaffler's bill. I would echo Representative March's comments on that. I think only that it is imperative that one of these bills move forward, and I ask you to give them your careful consideration and know that you will. So thank you very much for the opportunity to come here and testify on this, and if I sound a little impassioned about the Oregon Project Independence, it is because I truly am. And I've had too many occasions as a representative to see this particular program work. I could take a long time in your in your meeting this morning to go over many of those issues, but I won't do that. But if you don't, if the bill doesn't move forward, be assured I'll be back somewhere individually to tell you about each and every one of those case histories that I have. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the privilege and opportunity to be here with you this morning.
Thank you, Representative Jensen. Boy, we miss your wit on our committee. My goodness. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Any additional questions or comments, Representative Boone?
I just have a comment. And I've been in this building for a long time, about 17 years, and a few times I get pretty impassioned about what I see happen. But as a staffer, I wasn't allowed to do much about it other than just fume. And this is one of them. And the times that money has been taken from this program that over and over proves itself to be, as you say, a money saver. But not only that, but a dignity saver, everything. And just allows people to be in their own homes, which is what I plan to do, because after this weekend's dinner party, and my children said, "You guys are on your own." I plan to get real healthy and stay real healthy as much as I can. And I would feel bad if I had been in this position and not taken the opportunity to save something just such as great as this program is. So thanks for what you're doing. And Rep. Jensen, I'm right behind you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Cameron.
Well, I just want to thank all the representatives for bringing the bill forward. But I have a question directed at Representative Schaffler. There was a bill on the House floor the other day of which I voted no to lower the retirement age to age 50. So it passed the House floor, so I assume you're still under 50.
I'm 45 years old, for the record.
Okay. All right. Just wanted to clarify that for the record. I voted no because 49 was not the age limit.
Representative Greenlee.
No, when you get to a certain point, you want to change your age to Celsius, which I did last year. When I became 21 Celsius on the birthday before then. Thank you. Representative March, I really trust your judgment on this. You made a comment about the 2555 modernizing it. Can you point out where that is? I just had a couple minutes to look at the bill, and I don't see any significant differences, but I may just be missing a word somewhere.
Doesn't specifically refer to it, but the when 2555 was developed, the presumption was the modernization process that was going to be carried on at the same time. I honestly thought it was indicated in the bill, and so I apologize for that misspeak. The intent was there, but so I'm sure other people that are going to talk are going to mention the modernization aspect. The one thing I want to point out is this won't solve all of OPI's funding issues, but it will provide a base funding level that is dedicated and would be more than what happens every 2 years, at least since I've been in the building, actually more often than every 2 years with all the special sessions. But OPI, because it was 100% general funded, was offered up for cuts at every juncture. And both bills will provide a base amount of funding coming in on a regular basis, and that part of that will be determined. You have to keep a little reserve in that property tax deferral program fund. But I'm glad you pointed that out. I was operating under what I knew was the intent down the line.
It wouldn't hurt to have an LC kind of, but I think the only difference is Section 5 on in 2555, something about transferring the money, is not in 2626. So, I mean, basically, if we sign March and Jensen, I think is already on, to 2555, we probably have the vehicle that...
That would be fine because it requires a maintenance of effort, I was told, and that is the difference. My bill didn't have that provision, and I think we need a proviso, although the current main effort is inadequate.
Yes.
So we'd want to increase the maintenance of effort baseline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen, very much.
Representative Jensen, I can comment trading a sociologist for a CPA has not been a good trade for this committee.
He's not here.
Oh, I'm sorry he's not here.
Hopefully he can't hear you.
No, I would have liked it directed to you.
Ouch. Okay, all right. Well, and incidentally, both these bills have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. If there's anybody in the audience that wanted to testify on these bills, make sure that you're signed up. I put the sign-up sheets back there just to catch the last set of folks. Is Chris Mattson here? Chris Mattson coming forward to speak for Representative Bob Ackerman. Good morning. Welcome.
Thanks. For the record, my name is Chris Mattson. I'm the Chief of Staff for State Representative Robert Ackerman, who could not be here today because he's chairing a Judiciary Subcommittee and had a couple of bills that required his attention in the committee. And I apologize for not having any written testimony because in the process of doing that, I had to do a lot of research and work on his testimony in that committee. And it was either stay up and finish the written testimony or sleep, and for some selfish reason I chose sleep. As you are aware, House Bill 2555, which Representative Ackerman has signed on to, although he does support both bills, redirects unused surplus funds from the Senior Disabled Property Tax Deferral Program to a slightly expanded Oregon Project Independence Fund. Representative Vackerman has always and will continue to support Oregon Project Independence. It is preventative medicine, in his opinion. By spending a relatively modest amount of money now to fund this program, we help those seniors and disabled people eligible for this program to keep their independence, promote long-term care planning, and offer an alternative to more intense and thus more costly public programs. There's a certain logic in having unused surplus funds from one senior and disabled program directed into another senior and disabled program, particularly one that has seen drastic cuts in funding, and every biennium has a problem trying to secure that. And in fact, in the last biennium, was eliminated from the governor's proposed budget. This proposal, House Bill 2555, as well as the other one, issues a certain level of funding certainty that this program has not experienced since its inception. The representative also wanted to make it clear that even though that these bills are very good and he does support them, he does believe that these will not solve the problem that we have in Oregon right now in ensuring adequate funding for our vital and senior and disabled care programs, particularly the relative foster care program cuts and what he views as a cruel policy of capping the number of seniors and disabled folks that we can serve. Folks who desperately need these vital state programs. However, this is a start. And he would like you to keep in mind that unlike other state services, when we make massive cuts to senior and disabled programs and health care in general, the impact is that people die. And I can relate to that because over the last Christmas season, I watched my ex-wife bury my ex-mother-in-law due to complications from her disease, but the fact of the matter was that she had her in-home health care cut several months before, and her health deteriorated rapidly because the family was unable to provide that care as a substitute. Any questions?
I think we're all set. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
All right, we've got quite a few people that want to testify on these two bills, so I'm going to ask you to try to limit your comments to about 3 or 4 minutes if you can, but we won't kick you out if you go over. Ruth McEwen and Lucille Pugh, please. Okay. Good morning, welcome.
Good morning. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Lucille Pugh, and I am in favor of the bills before you and that information which incorporates the what we term the Modernization Act relative to Oregon Project Independence. I would like to make an opening statement with respect to why I support this legislation. I was one of the people way back when enabling legislation for senior and people with disabilities, the long-term care system passed. For a number of years, I worked at the state office level in terms of implementing these programs, and since my retirement I've worked almost as hard as an advocate. I truly have seen the difference that the long-term care system has made in the lives of older and people with disabilities. I remember the time when there was no option except nursing home care, even though a person might have very few medical needs but simply needed a place to stay because they were unable to assist themselves in independent living. And one of the things that both Oregon Project Independence and the Medicaid programs have focused on is to assure that people have the opportunity to live independently and to have those services which provides that independence. I've seen this make a real difference in lives of people I had known, both friends and through the work situation. It's for this reason that I not only support the OPI Modernization Act, which would extend OPI to persons with physical disabilities, that is, adults. It's a minimum amount of money, which in the long run saves more expensive care. It's kind of a support that is just enough to help a person maintain their independence in their own living situation. I think the other part of the Modernization Act, as well as covering OPI for disabled persons, adults, is the endeavor to assure that seniors and people with disabilities have opportunities to educate themselves with respect to those things that they can do, perhaps early on, to preserve their independent status. It will provide opportunities for a number of ways to communicate with them, and in some instances where personal intervention or information needs to be provided, it would provide for this. I think that this is money well spent, and that to do less than this and to maintain the long-term care system, we will find increasing costs and increasing dependency among people with disabilities and seniors. I do thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Jackson Zimmer-Jones, please.
Madam Vice Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jacqueline Zimmer, and I'm the Executive Director of O4AD, the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities, and thank you for your attention today. Before I begin my testimony, let me just clear up a little bit of confusion I think that the two different bills have generated this morning for you, and that is that House Bill 2555 is different than 2626 in that it calls for a maintenance of effort. In other words, it calls for the state to continue the maintenance of effort for Oregon Project Independence that's required by the federal government to pull down Older Americans Act dollars. It's not a match per se, but it is required that the state invest in a value program of some sort for seniors in order to pull down Older Americans Act dollars. And our concern with using surplus funds in the senior property tax deferral program was that legislators would then pull the existing general fund money out of Oregon Project Independence and sort of do a backfill with senior property tax deferral money. And we just didn't want to risk losing that maintenance of effort.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Which section is that?
I think that's Section 5, Madam Chair, Representative Greenlick. It's Section 5 in House Bill 2555. And I can't say with all certainty that that's exactly, that was the intent anyway, was that the state be required to continue the maintenance of effort in the general fund, through the general fund.
I don't believe that's what Section 5 says. So.
Madam Vice Chair,
before we put on the record the intent of the bill, we ought to make sure we have the language that...
We're not entirely certain that that's what that says either, but we proceeded with
you're wanting
that is our intent, right.
Great, thank you.
Right.
Was there anything else, Jacqueline?
Sure, certainly. The advocates have been looking for a long time for an adequate funding source for Oregon Project Independence, and since 1996, the Senior and Disabled Property Tax Deferral Program has given $51 million back to the general fund by charging just a simple 6% interest rate on property tax deferrals. And I believe there are about 10,000 seniors and now people with disabilities using the program as well. There might be about 400 people with physical disabilities who are using this. Household income once you're in the program is limited to $32,000 annually. So these are people that are living with the rising property tax rates and probably fairly stable or declining incomes. So the value of the program can't be understated. The latest fund shift from this account backfilled a $7 million hole in the Department of Revenue's budget. I think we talked about that earlier just before it happened. But there is money in this fund to make payments to counties. That's not at risk. But last biennium, $25 million was removed from this program to cover shortfalls in the general fund. And coincidentally, we lost about $25 million in general fund dollars to programs for seniors and people with disabilities. So we have 8,700 people lost services under the medically needy program. Several thousand people lost their in-home care and their Oregon Health Plan coverage because they were at levels 12 through 17. The legislature reinstated 12 and 13, but still those people in the 13 to 17 population are still floating around without help. Several people have referred today to the Oregon Project Independence Modernization Act of 2005. That's not incorporated into this bill at this time. That's a policy change that the legislature will have to make first. The policy change pertains to people with physical disabilities that are younger being able to access OPI. And I bring that up to you now because, as I discussed the cuts from the previous session, in our offices, most of our offices serve seniors and people with physical disabilities side by side. And seniors who lost their Medicaid help and their Oregon Health Plan coverage, some of them could turn to Oregon Project Independence, or sort of what was left of it last biennium, to get some in-home care, but people with physical disabilities could not. So we don't really, so OPI has almost kind of become a safety net by virtue of those particular cuts. I mean, it's always been a safety net, but then it really became a safety net for people who were getting Medicaid help. But it seems unfair and unfortunate that people with physical disabilities don't have an OPI to turn to. I wasn't going to get into the details of the Oregon Project Independence Modernization Act, but just for your information, I think a lot of people believe the state isn't poised to handle the demographic trends coming its way, and the Modernization Act is set to help people with self-sufficiency, self-reliance, and to spend their money wisely as they approach their twilight years. And so that would include simple things like a website that has massive amounts of information that families and this population could access to help them spend their money wisely and remain in their homes longer. It includes a platform for the promotion of long-term care insurance here in Oregon, which would certainly probably keep some people from ending up at the state's doorstep, and also an opportunity for citizens and family members to come in and access the case managers and help put good care plans together for their families so that they can, again, spend their money wisely and be comfortable in their own homes. And so those are some of the primary components of the Modernization Act, but it's not necessarily included in either one of these bills. What we're looking for is just some funding that we can depend upon for Oregon Project Independence while we watch the general fund decline. So,
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Tomei.
Thank you. Jacqueline, I just want to call our attention to the second page when you mentioned that maintenance effort calls for $3.9 million in general funds, Oregon funds, to bring down $26 million in federal funds for the Older Americans Act. I just think it's imperative for us to bring these federal funds that we're paying out to the federal government, bring some of these back for our older citizens.
Representative Dalton and Tomei, I would agree. We talk a lot about federal match and how important that is. Again, this isn't a federal match, but technically that those dollars go out around the state and help seniors with their independence and so and their health.
Okay, Representative Cameron.
Jacqueline, thank you. Our resident CPA is not here, so I'm going to ask the question. How much funding are we talking about that would come from this interest that's earned to OPI, and what is the overall percentage of the total amount that it represents? Do we know?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, there is somebody here from the Department of Revenue. Ideally, if we were to fully implement the Modernization Act, we would suggest that would be around $20 million. But funding right now for Oregon Project Independence is about $8.6 or $8.7 million. The governor's recommended budget essentially eliminates it. The Senate reinstates it at about $6.6 million, and the House budget does it at $11.1 million. In order just to continue serving the people we're serving right now, the $8.6 million would be necessary. But the tax deferral fund itself has enough money in it to pay the counties, and I'm not entirely sure what the surplus will be at the end of next biennium. It's been estimated to be around $3 to $5 million. So when we first began looking last biennium with Representative Jensen at this account, there was about $27 million to be projected in the ending surplus balance. That's gone. That money is gone. It's been used by the legislature for various purposes. So I'm not entirely sure how much money will be in there at the end of next biennium.
Okay. Thanks.
Sorry.
Sure. Representative Greenlee.
Can we clarify that match question? OPI money is not matched by federal dollars, is it? We're talking about a match for the Older American Act.
Correct, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenwick. We pull down about, I think it's 26 to 29 million, I can't think the number shifts, in Older Americans Act funding dollars for programs that the Area Agencies on Aging operate throughout Oregon. So you'll see that in many different ways: meal sites, Meals on Wheels, information referral, those sort of things.
But OPI dollars, as opposed to, say, state Medicaid long-term care dollars, are not matched by federal dollars. These are essentially funded by the general fund dollars.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenwood, that is correct. Right. And we have looked at a number of occasions for opportunities to match federal dollars to Oregon Project Independence, but have been turned down.
Thwarted.
It's a Medicaid avoidance program. And it's 30 years old, and it was designed before we had our Medicaid waiver. And it does not, since it's not a Medicaid program, it doesn't pull down matching Medicaid dollars. However, we know that I think only about 2% of the people using Oregon Project Independence have an income over $1,500 a month. Most of the people using Oregon Project Independence are, in fact, very vulnerable financially. Those people in Oregon who do have resources who use the program pay for it on a sliding scale fee. So some people may pay as little as 29 cents an hour for services they receive under Oregon Project Independence. Some pay full fare. In some parts of the state, there are no services for a senior to turn to when they want to remain in their own home. We are it. And so Oregon Project Independence is on occasion used by people with resources, but they do, in fact, then pay full fare for it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thanks, Jacqueline.
You're welcome.
Okay. Is Eunice Dutton available? And also bring up Lee Hazelwood. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Chairman Dalto and members of the committee. My name is Eunice Dutton, and I'm pleased to have an opportunity to testify before you today on behalf of the Governor's Commission of Senior Services and in support of House Bill 2555, concerning Oregon Project Independence. In addition to being vice chair on the Governor's Commission, I'm a former OPI caseworker for 25 years in Douglas County with Senior Services, the division of DHS, and this subject is very close to my heart. As you know, Oregon Project Independence was an innovative program for long-term care for persons over the age of 60 who are in need of assistance, allowing them to remain in their own home with independence and dignity. This program also assists those that are diagnosed with Alzheimer's to be able to remain at home as long as possible or with a spouse who is a total care provider in their own home. The program provides home care, daycare, and other supportive services for persons to assist it to at risk of being institutionalized. Over the past several bienniums, OPI has been threatened by budget cuts for as long as I can ever remember. The average cost for a client to be in their own home is about $109. Compared to a foster home would be over $500 and a nursing home would be $1,000. Nearly 80% of the OPI clients are females between the ages of 71 and 90. Each client, as you know, shares a part of the cost depending on their income. The money is then used and put back into the program to provide services to others. Mr. Chairman, and the aging of Oregon's population and the need for services continues to grow dramatically. Although we focus on service offerings and reductions at the state level, local agencies also have had to refuse services, put people on waiting lists, and makes a further increasing the stress on our system. Oregon Project Independence is a cost-effective alternative to premature institutionalization of our seniors. For some time, the Governor's Commission on Senior Services has called for a designated, dedicated, and durable funding source for this vital program. House Bill 2555 would establish something that many of us have sought over several years, a means of relieving the general fund of some of the cost of this critical program that would be protected from being transferred for other uses. One of the important points in this bill is that the money still in the fund for OPI at the end of the biennium would be retained in the fund for future use by the OPI program. Mr. Chairman, it's a privilege to be here today to testify before you in support of a program that makes tremendous difference in the lives of the countless senior citizens and their families and reduces the need for more expensive care and more intensive services that would cost the state more money to deliver. Later this session, you'll have an opportunity to make history by expanding the focus of OPI program to include people with disabilities. Out of this hearing and the work you do here on House Bill 2555, you'll have an opportunity to make history by creating a designated, dedicated, and durable funding source for this vital program, saving money in the long run for the needed services for our elderly. Thank you for your work and dedication. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Mr. Hazelwood.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lee Hazelwood. I live in Staten, Oregon. I'm a longtime advocate for senior and people with disabilities. I'm also a former member of the Governor's Commission under the last three governors. I'm also a member of the Northwest Seniors and People with Disabilities, which formerly was Mid-Willamette Valley Senior Service Agency, but now Marion, Polk, and Yamhill County and Clatsop and Tillamook County are included in that group. But I do, and also I'm a board member of United States of Oregon, but I do not speak for those two people. I come before you today to talk about Oregon Project Independence, commonly referred to as OPI. In your hands is the history of OPI that I've included with your my testimony, including the how and why it got started. It's always amazing to me to see the number of people back here supporting OPI that I've been doing for over 20 years. I think it's a great program keeping people in their own home as long as possible. It saves the state millions of dollars over the years. And so in the old days, you used to get a star on your paper when you did a good job. And so I think we need another, maybe a thousand stars. In 1973, while promoting a proposal which eventually became OPI, then Governor Bob Straub said, "It is, in my opinion, a disservice to place a man or woman in an institution when, with a little help, the person can remain in his or her home and community. For many, the long-time dream of dignity comfort and independence in retirement has become a nightmare of dread. Instead, there is a cruel tarnish on their golden years. In 1975, Governor Bob Straub signed Oregon Project Independence into law. And sitting behind me is a young Billy Graham, or formerly known as Ralph Groner, who was a member of that group who started this. But during the 2001 session, the then Speaker of the House appointed a task force chaired by Representative Jackie Winters and made up of members of both parties. The task force held meetings around the state and took testimony from numerous groups and individuals about the impacts of cuts to seniors and people with disabilities. Needless to say, the task force final report listed OPI as a top priority. Many seniors are totally reliant upon the state's assistance to provide the necessary service they receive from OPI. And in my testimony is some of the facts that you've already heard, so I'm not going to repeat those. But remember, these are real people, and I urge you to pass these bills. And incidentally, due to where I live, my representative, Representative Jeff Krupp, has a bill 2587 that funds OPI, and that happens to be in the Ways and Means Committee. But I also like to reply back to a number of things you've heard. During numerous special sessions that I hung on to, looking for ways to fund OPI, desperately seeking ways to fund OPI, I sat through a hearing and heard testimony about the senior property tax deferral. And I have copies of questions that have been asked about the senior property tax deferral. I thought, well, when things really get tough, you have to look for ways to find it for money. And so I discovered senior property tax deferral. I did not want to disrupt that program because it's a crucial program. But also, I'm in love with OPI. I hope my tombstone says he supported OPI or Mr. OPI.
It'll have a big gold star on it.
But but also the question was asked about modernization. And unfortunately, Senate Bill 870, I testified against that bill. Not because it is a good bill, but there's not enough money now to service the people in Oregon Project Independence. Until the time when there's more funding, I'll totally support that. But in the meantime, I cannot do that. So I'm available for any questions or...
Representative Cameron?
Mr. Hazelwood, thanks for coming here, and I just want to, I don't know what your tombstone will say, but since I was 6 weeks behind everybody getting here, you are the biggest voice in this Capitol for the people sitting in this room, and I just want to thank you for carrying that flag and meeting with us and educating those of us that need to be educated.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chairman, I have to be nice to him today. They're allies, so I'm not going to pick on
him. Mr. Chair...
Would you be nice to Lee Hazelwood every day?
Yep.
Mr. Chair, if possible, I would like to read something that was posted. They have different pictures of different people out in the state of Oregon, and I'd like to read this. Senator Gordley and I were admiring this and thought, this is a number of years back, and I've never forgotten it. And we shall leave the next generation... a state which, because of our efforts, has become a better place in which to live. And those words were written by Amy Gorham, 1936, Scenes of Pioneer Panel, Alameda Elementary School, Portland, Oregon. And just things kind of stick in your mind and you think, have I made a difference? Thank you.
You have.
Thank you for making a difference, Lee. Okay. This is just great. Ralph Groner.
Now, nobody said I have to be nice to Ralph.
What is it that we say Ralph Groner? Just everybody knows what's
old.
Good morning and welcome.
Mr. Chairman, I'll speak loudly because, one, I'm hearing impaired, but I'm assuming, having worked with seniors before any other job in my life, That there are a number of hearing impaired, and one thing I dislike about the Capitol is if you're sitting in the back with someone facing you, it would be better had they developed this way so the voice was going evenly. And I am hearing impaired, and I'm speaking in behalf of the hearing impaired today. For the record, my name is Ralph Groner. I've been asked by Lee Hazelwood and seniors every session to come back on Project Independence, so I really appreciate that. I'd like to talk to you a moment about, I co-chaired the committee that created Project Independence, and that's really not a credit at all to me. I want to make it very clear, a difference, and I don't mean to alienate anyone here, I'm probably going to. The difference in the political climate in 73 when I started it, I really started, let me begin this, working for what was called the War on Poverty in Clackamas County right out of U of O. I'm sorry, I know it's OSU for you, but I'm a duck and I still love OSU. I want you to know that I was hired to become the program director of No Programs. When we worked on the War on Poverty for very little, if any, money, the fact was I had my job was to organize the seniors of Clackamas County from nothing. No buses, no food, nothing. Because I went to work with a guy named Tom McCall, who became a very dear friend of mine, we put together a function at our county fair where over 2,000 seniors were brought by volunteers on buses from my community college president, etc. My Steelheaders, which I was president of, fed the seniors. Derek Gold contributed. Monty Blue, his jazz band played, everything donated. Out of that came our senior council, the first of its type in the state, and out of that came buses, out of that came my membership with another friend of mine on creating what's called Loaves and Fishes, maybe you haven't heard of that, but I was involved in its creation, luckily. And because I was in my 20s, I was still creative and never tired. And the result was I ran for the legislature, and I should have told you my boss statewide, and still one of my dearest friends, was Jackie Winters. If you wonder why we like her so much, it has nothing to do really with the fact she is very fair to my union, but she also was my boss and encouraged me to work very hard in Clackamas County to organize. She was the head of the state War on Poverty at the time. I was then named, let me see, in 73 there were, Tom McCall was governor, and in 75 Bob Straub, let me clarify that, was governor. What happened was a lot of work was going on in Oregon to try to say, can't we save money because our nursing home costs were soaring. I'm going to do this a different way. An inordinate amount of money was going out of our budget toward long-term care, nursing home care. Because people like Ruth Shepherd, I don't know if Ruth is here, wonderful advocate, and because a number of people were advocating and working so hard in behalf of seniors, all volunteers, the fact of the matter was Congress said, hold it, what's going on in Oregon? And at that time, and by 75, the speaker became Phil Lang, who's still around. He's the chair of Oregon Liquor Control Commission. His wife lobbies here. It's a small world. Jenny, for Quest. Now, on the committee that I was named by Phil Lang, just so you know why, it was because in my county and statewide, I had become accidentally a voice, and I found it ironic for people that are the age I am now, even though I really was like Representative Dalto, a very young person, Phil made me chair of the committee. Interestingly, I believe the politics was so different in 73-75 that I hope and pray that both parties can understand why we accomplished so much in 75 and 73. Had nothing to do with what you may have heard. It had to do with people on my committee such as Sam Johnson, whose daughter is now a state senator here, Betsy. I love Sam Johnson. I had grown up in a union household, by the way, and had been told that Republicans were, you had to stay away from them. They could be very dangerous and I wouldn't get into heaven. And what the fact of the matter was, I learned from my friend Sam Johnson, and I'm looking, George Wingard was on my committee, senator out of Eugene, and here I had Tom McCall had called me grown and became my buddy. I actually learned my dad was wrong about Republicans, and now when I look at Billy and when I look at Rep. Anderson and Rep. Cameron, I'm kind of schmoozing here. We have potential. We have
potential.
We have potential for people to work again and cross the aisles.
Ralph, normally people talk to the bill when they... I'm enjoying the history lesson, but we've got a lot of work ahead of us.
I will. I do want you to know that Senator Packwood asked Oregon to provide it, so he got us a grant. Just so you know, it wasn't general fund funded. We were funded. All of our work was funded. At that time, Jim Davis, Dr. Davis, was hired by me. I had a young college graduate named Ron Wyden we interviewed. I had the good fortune of hiring. We never give enough credit to our Rhodes Scholar, who really was brilliant, Alan Manuel, and he became a multimillionaire. So we never talk about him. We only talk about middle income and poor people. So at any rate, I'd like to say to you that I of course am here to support it, but I'm thinking different than most folks do when it comes to Project Independence. It went back to Bob Packwood, and frankly, you were the national model. And one of the comments that wasn't answered, I believe, by Rep. Greenlicht, and you were gone, but I want to answer that. What Project Independence was very clearly to do, and quite specifically, was to reduce the cost of institutionalization, which was very and is still very expensive. I could have answered your question by saying...
Question to which that's the answer.
What'd you say?
I said, what was the question to which that's the answer?
You asked, use Medicaid dollars.
Yeah.
And I'm going to answer that. The truth of the matter is, Project Independence has saved this state and its general fund many, 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 and I could go on. And you can have that documented by the agency of millions of dollars. Had we not done that and had you went by the governor's recommendation, just cut it. The fact is, you will see very soon people doing just what they did, and that is back in the nursing homes. Now you will have your Medicaid match. Now you will have, but you will have higher costs from the state general fund. And I got thinking about two agencies that ought to be adequately funded, both adequately funded in the House budget, but not the Senate. One is OPI saves you dollars, and I can show you how. And the other one is OHSU. For every dollar you give them, they create 27. So they're putting money in. One saves, the other puts in. I'm not a brilliant person, but I'll say if you're that kind of person, I'm going to fund you right up front and everyone else here. So I just want to say that Project Independence wasn't a dream of a Democrat nor of a Republican. It was a mixture, and I hope it will continue to be, of people who had foresight, some of whom I've named, that I hope that will continue to not only help seniors and the disabled in Oregon, but quite frankly, we're helping K-12, U of O, OSU, because we're saving dollars that are available and can be documented in the general fund to help every other program. So, yes, I'm a big advocate of Project Independence, but I would hope you'd be a bigger advocate. I support an amendment to 2555 or a separate bill. We'll let Rep. Cameron maybe his first bill. That is, for every dollar OPI saves, which can be documented, I believe a percentage ought to go into this fund where it can't be touched for anything. And that's the kind of thing we ought to be doing with agencies. You save us money, we're going to reward you. We're not rewarding people in this state and agencies to do that. So, I know you're not Ways and Means, but you could do an amendment, a separate bill, that says, if you're going to save us that kind of money, we'll give 20%, we'll go into the separate account along with your property tax surplus to help OPI. Any questions, Mr. Chair?
I think we're all set, Ralph.
Could I ask you a brief question?
Yes.
Thank you.
I mean, I do want to comment on the Medicaid match question. Jackie pointed out that people who are covered by long-term care Medicaid are the same people who end up being covered by OPI, and I love OPI. You know, as a, I was in the war in poverty with you and a variety of things. But if we're putting a cap on the number of people that can use long-term care Medicaid, and we have a limited amount of dollars, a dollar of general funds that brings also $1.70 of federal funds with it is more powerful in serving that same population. And I think we need to be careful not to get in a war between funding for OPI and funding for long-term care under Medicaid, for the home and community-based waiver under Medicare, as long as these are the same people we're serving. So to a certain extent, I mean, we shouldn't be competing these against each other. They both are doing the job that needs to be done.
Mr. Chair, Rep. Green, that's a great comment, and we did grow up in the war on poverty together, and I appreciate that. My only comment would be, but even though it's only a dollar, you're saving many, many dollars that can go into that program, if you want to pick long-term care, with Project Independence. Without adequately funding Project Independence, you would, in fact, increase your general fund cost.
That's unless you put a limit on it so those people can't get on either program. That's the problem.
That is a problem. There should be no limit. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And can I just say, do not answer a cell phone in my committee room. You know, I think it's pretty rude. So if you have business to take care of, take it outside before you answer the cell phone. So with that, I'd like to call up Rick Bennett with the AARP of Oregon.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Rick Bennett, representing AARP Oregon. I was not a senior when Ralph began his remarks, but I think I'm qualified. I will be very brief. AARP Oregon supports both House Bill 2555 and 2626. The OPI has been a very successful program, both in managing the taxpayers' dollars and in providing and enhancing the quality of life and independence of many of its citizens. We also support the comments that Jacqueline Zimmer made related to using these dollars that are mentioned in the bills to supplement rather than supplant general fund dollars. Thank you.
Thank you, Rick. What do we do before cell phones, by the way? Do we know? I just have that question. Thanks. Jim Davis. And if Ruth McEwen arrives at the Capitol, we'll take her anytime she gets here, just in case you guys see her a little bit later. So good morning. Welcome, Jim.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jim Davis, representing the Advocacy Coalition of Seniors and People with Disabilities, United Seniors of Oregon, Great Panthers, Oregon Association for Retired Citizens, and Save Oregon Seniors. We are here to express our very strong support for House Bill 2550 and House Bill 2626, both of which would allocate excess monies from the Senior Property Tax Deferral Revolving Account to Oregon Project Independence, the newly created fund.
2555, Jim.
Oh, excuse me. I misspoke myself. I apologize for that. We were most concerned earlier in the session when millions of dollars in excess monies were taken from the Senior Property Tax Deferral Program and simply went into the general fund to make up for a budget shortfall. We feel that monies from a senior program of this kind should be dedicated to senior and disability services or some other kind of senior program. And in this case, we're strongly supporting that being OPI. When we look at the recommendations, the very severe recommendations for cuts in seniors and people with disabilities budget, we see that potentially the Oregon long-term care system could be further crippled. Thousands more seniors and people with disabilities could lose their services and lose their independence in their own communities. OPI has been the wonderful safety net to catch those that don't qualify for Medicaid benefits and enable them to have in-home and community-based services. I was there in the beginning, as Ralph said. I was an intern been on the House Committee on Aging and very involved with that process. And so as a gerontologist, I have watched OPI grow into a national model. And I've seen it reach tens of thousands of seniors and people with disabilities each month with wonderful and needed community-based services. So these clients tend to be people who are near poor, who don't have any other options, and they end up oftentimes spending down their savings and ending up Medicaid eligible. So ultimately the state will be responsible, but if we don't take care of them earlier in their long-term care needs, ultimately we're going to pay a lot more money anyway. So it makes more sense to be able to reach out to these individuals at this point. We appreciate this effort to address these serious senior and disability funding issues. We urge your support of House Bill 2555 and House Bill 2626.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. All right. Seeing nobody else signed up for these bills, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2555, close the public hearing on House Bill 2626. We are, I don't see Senator Lim here yet. So. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3311. This is the bill that requires the Department of Human Services to sponsor public service announcements and distribute pamphlets concerning elevated blood level. And we'll invite Ted Hughes forward, please.
I still have a little trouble with the honor.
Good morning, welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I was here and watched young Ralphie Groner, and we used to call him young Ralphie at that time. What he told you was reasonably accurate. He did all of that stuff, plus more. And I won't go into the plus more at that time. But he is not misrepresenting himself at all. I want you to know that. Ted Hughes, representing the Pacific Northwest Paint Council. The Paint Council is a division of the National Paint and Coatings Association. We represent the paint and coatings industry in both Oregon and Washington. This bill is a product of National's endeavor 4 years ago. They retained the University of Maryland to take a look at the childhood lead poisoning situation in the United States. And a very responsible move. They formed task forces. They traveled the country. And the reason, of course, is that childhood lead poisoning is the responsibility of the paint industry, quite frankly, and we wanted to be proactive. So they took a look at it and decided to draft a model bill addressing it. The model bill was very, very aggressive. It had lots of elements in it. One of the elements is an education program, and that's why we introduced 3311. Here in Oregon, we introduced this bill 2 years ago, and we did the aggressive bill. We caused inspections of residents, licensing and certification of inspectors. I mean, it did everything that the National Model Bill asked us to do. In the process, we start talking to the health divisions in the counties and the cities, Department of Human Resources and the health division in the state, and found out after about a week of meetings that the problem in Oregon is really not that grave and that severe to call for the full-fledged model bill. So at that time we asked we pulled the bill and said, let's take another look at it and introduce just an element of it, the education element this year. By the way, I should have told you that when we took the bill to Legislative Council, we asked Legislative Council to not make it mandatory, to make it may instead of shall, and the bill came out of Legislative Council as shall. And therefore, we had to go back in and request an amendment. The -1 amendment that you have, Mr. Chairman, makes it permissive, makes it may. And we would ask you to adopt that -1 amendment because we realize, as well as the Department of Human Resources realize, that we cannot mandate a program for them that at this point in time is not that identifiable. A may will help us work with them in the interim until we help us decide what kind of education, public education program is necessary. And together we will get this underway, this interim. But we'd like to have the enabling legislation. So I have furnished the committee with a small summary sheet of the problem. And so I'm going to stop.
Okay, let me just see if I can clarify this in my mind. So you've got a bill here that is asking the Department of Human Services to provide information and distribute information concerning these blood levels, these elevated blood levels that may come as a result of exposure to lead paint, and you've made that permissive. So they are not forced to do it, and it sounds like your association is going to work with the department to make the materials available so that there isn't a cost for those materials. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. We will help them prepare the proper pamphlets and public service announcements to make the public aware of lead poisoning. By the way, the industry has not put lead in their paint since 1978, but we still have the older buildings and the older residents that have it, and we know as an industry how to deal with it.
Okay. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ted, then will the paint industry be paying for these studies and these the certification and accreditation program and the educational materials that will be going out?
We will be paying quite a bit for it, Representative Tomei. Not the whole cost. Once we identify with the Department of Human Resources what is necessary, we will bundle up some of the monies to help the program.
Is that in the bill that I just missed?
No, it is not. No. We left most of the model bill out and just went to the education right now while we determined the level of the problem in Oregon. We suspect it's not very high, and so we just did a modest program here.
But it sounds like then what this bill would do is require the Department of Human Services to come up with these funds, may come up with them, rather than the paint industry be paying for these.
Well, I believe the trends are nationwide where these bills, the entire bill has become law. The industry sets together a work group with the government agency and the industry actually does, in cooperation with them, produce the pamphlets and help produce the television and radio spots that the education program calls for.
But
yes, we will be helping. We're probably going to ask, if it's an extensive program, for some funds from the Department of Human Resources and help them get it through the emergency board or through the next legislative session.
But just to clarify for myself then, but it's not requiring the paint industry to pay for
anything. No, it is not.
Okay, thank you.
No, I don't think I'd have my client very long if I decided to do that.
Okay, Representative Greenlink and then Anderson.
Yeah, Ted, you can help me. I don't understand why we have this bill, particularly why we have Section 3. Because certainly there's nothing in current law that would prevent DHS from doing this. Is there?
No, there isn't.
In Section 4.
Mr. Chairman, there is not. And as a matter of fact, DHS in Oregon is very, very responsible. They are on top of this issue. It's not a big priority with them. We want to make it more of a priority, and that's why we introduced this bill.
Mr. Chairman,
but they do a good, adequate job now in so far as childhood lead poisoning is concerned.
If you say shall, as the original bill is written, I understand why it becomes a priority. Giving them permission to do something they already do, I don't understand why it gives them any sense that it's a
priority. Even though, Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlake, they do it to a degree, there is no widespread education with the general public about the subject, and that's what we want to bring forward. And it'll cause, we hope it'll cause the Department of Human Resources and ourselves, the industry, to work together to figure out a broad educational program. That's why we did this, to move it up on their priority list, sir.
Okay, I think your point's made, Rick.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, I love passing bills, but passing a bill that doesn't do anything seems to me not necessarily very useful. I mean, if we want to say to them it ought to become a priority, then we ought to amend it to say this ought to become a priority of the, or we ought to give them a budget note that says this ought to be a priority. But to give them permission to do something they already have permission to.
Okay.
We hope that it'll raise the flag in the agency, and that they will pay, even though they do pay attention, more attention to this subject.
Okay, thanks very much, Mr. Hughes. I'm gonna close the public hearing on House Bill 3311. I'm gonna open a public hearing on House Bill 2672. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2672 is requiring retail sellers of Oriental Pharmacopoeia to label the products with the content and weight information and to register the information with the Board of Medical Examiners. It also authorizes the BME to establish fees, registration requirements to enforce any civil penalties. It creates or establishes a violation, Class C misdemeanor with a with a maximum violation of 30 days imprisonment or $1,250 fine. And Representative John Lim is here to speak to the bill. And you, hopefully with your materials you have a dash one amendment attached.
Thank you, Chair Dalto and members of the committee. Good morning. And I appreciate the hearing of my bill, House Bill 2672. I came from Korea, from Asian country. That the pharmacopoeia is one of the important things in the country, and which is also in America also. The issues I'm talking about this morning is that the public safety is the number one issue in our country. And many people coming from Asia, they claim to be a herbal doctor without a proper license. Sometimes without the proper education, they just open up and then begin to prescribe under the name of this is good for the body, and charging $300, $400, $500 for just, they just wrap them in the paper, 10 or 20, and then give it to them, and they took that to their home, and they boil it and they drink it. They don't know what they are drinking for. They don't know what it's good for. They don't know what's in the content in it. It is the area that uncharted in our country here. Sometimes people are pregnant, that the ladies are pregnant, and they are diabetic, and heart problems. Some of them could be allergic to their body, and plus many others. And somehow this area needs to be regulated. Already federal law require any food product, if it's considered food, if it's considered drug, that has to have a proper label what's in it. I'm not asking anything other than what is required, that the people need to know what's in it. The bill that the House Bill 2672 is simply asking to put a label on it and a weight on it, what's the contents in it, what they are taking. I have known some story back in Korea, some of them were killed, some of them miscarriages of the babies, some of them that they are deeply hurt with this kind of things of their health. In this world, the 21st century, this is not the world of the 19th century. This is the world of strong scientific, and then it is a right thing to do, that the right to know what's in it, and the simplicity requiring that the labels on the contents of it, and then this is a good thing for the state and for the people. This is completely unregulated in our country and in our state. Anyone wants to do these kind of things has to have a license of acupuncture. At least they should have some knowledge on these things and regulated by the state. As I talked to the director of BME, and she's supportive of this bill, and that she thought this might be a good idea. And instead of a BME, I think it is much better to be regulated by the State Board of Pharmacy, which is the dash one amendment. And so with that, and I'm open to any questions.
Senator, Representative Lynn, I received a lot of correspondence on this bill from folks that have interest in a wide range of things, from acupuncture to the preparation of teas, you know, commercial teas, and honey, I think, producers. And there was a great concern that the way this bill was structured, that it had pretty wide application and would cause some of those individuals to have to register their products. But I don't think they are exactly what you're trying to get at. You described very specifically the sort of home remedies and people effectively trying to practice medicine without a license that you're trying to target. And so I'm wondering if you gave any thought to that.
Yes, this is specific to the pharmacopoeia bill, such as a claim to be the Oriental medical doctor. This has nothing to do with the honeys or teas. It's nothing mentioned it at all. The teas and honey, we all love it. We know this is good things, not only in our state and worldwide. It has nothing to do with it. And this is specific. The bill has to do with the pharmacopoeia, which is, I believe, it is, I don't know what it's good for, but somehow has to be regulated. Without it, we are heading into sometime in the future, someone will get hurt in physically, and then that in many different ways. I'm not asking them to stop it. Only I'm asking with this bill, make sure that when they are taking certain things, what is the content in it? And every citizen of our state has a right to know what's in it. If it's good for, what is good for? If it's something in there, what is in it? They just put in all kinds of stuff together, wrap it up in the paper, this is good for you. They are charging $400-$500 for that. And so this is the area we need to regulate it. Of course, people doesn't want to be regulated. They want to be free to sell any drugs and anything. But simply, our country cannot afford to do that at this time.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Green.
I support this bill, and I support the concept behind this bill. I think the problem is that the definition of the pharmacopoeia means any herbs or dietary supplements described in traditional Oriental medicine texts. And there could be a lot of things. I mean, it could talk in that text about how to use butter. It could talk in that text about how to use honey. It would seem to me an amendment to that definition that excludes products in common commercial use. I'm not sure what that term is. To deal with, for example, ordinary teas and honeys and other things that I think are included in those textbooks as having beneficial effects might be the way to limit the scope of this in a way that would be acceptable. And I think that's the issue. It's on line 8 through 10. Right, yeah, 8 through 10 of the first page. And I think it would be possible for the LC to work with Representative Lim to create an exclusion in that definition for things commonly sold in grocery stores and other kind of issues. And I'm sure Representative Lim doesn't intend to include those in the bill, and I think it can be worked out easily.
I absolutely agree to it, but as I read this bill here, the Chair Dalton and then Representative Greenleaf, I think that in my knowledge and the definition of Oriental pharmacopoeia is well defined here. It means herbs or the dietary supplements described in traditional Oriental text commonly used in accredited school of Oriental medicine. So this is clearly talking about the medicine, not any teas or any other things. But if you, that the members of this committee wants to more narrowly define on this bill, I have no objection to it.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree that we need to be careful, and there might need to be some exclusions, but I think that's up to the Board of Pharmacy to maybe make that determination of what's in the Oriental Book of Medicine and what isn't, and that they can make that clarification.
That could be a one option. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you for your bringing your bill and speaking to us today, Representative. But you suggested in Section 3 that a person may not sell at retail Oriental pharmacopoeia unless the person is registered with the Board of Medical Examiners. Are they? Is that common practice now?
Common practice in here or in Asia?
Here.
Here. I don't think so. When they claim to be a herb doctor, they don't have to be registered to anyone else.
And
at this time.
So have you contacted the Board of Medical Examiners to see if they would be interested in taking this new responsibility on?
When I took this, Chair Dalton and then Vice Chair Tomei, and when I discussed with them, and they agreed that this is the area non-regulated at all. So I agree to this is a good idea to begin with, and that this is not intended to tell them what to do, only just to find out what's in it, and so make sure this is safe enough to the public.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, and Representative Lim, why the Board of Medical Examiners regarding the retail sale of pharmacopoeia? Why not the Board of Pharmacy?
I don't have the professional knowledge. As I discussed with the director of BME, it suggested that this might be more that in line with the Board of Pharmacy instead of the Medical Board of Examiners. Medical Board of Examiners include medical doctors and that any other doctors related to it. Maybe this might be, in my opinion, also fit into the Board of the Pharmacy instead of a BME.
And just to sort of follow in my line of thinking there, Representative Lim, I think one of the things that you're trying to get at two issues. One is the practice of prescribing the pharmacopoeia that has some kind of effect. So the practice is one issue in my mind, and then the effect of the preparation itself is another effect. And so, at least in Oregon, we have a Board of Medical Examiners to regulate the practitioner of the care, and then the pharmacy, the Board of Pharmacy to oversee the distribution of the pharmacy products after that.
Mr. Chair, Section 4 of the dash ones does exactly that.
Okay.
It does switch it to the Board of Pharmacy.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Representative Lim, very much.
Okay. I'm done?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Tom Holt. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Tom Holt with the Oregon State Pharmacy Association. We're here in reluctant opposition to the bill. Representative Lim has identified an important public safety issue. Just because something is natural doesn't mean it's safe. We run into that even with commercially produced herbal medicines that are commonly sold in retail stores. There can be interactions with prescription drugs and so on. Our concern basically is in two areas. As Representative Dalto identified, there's really two issues here. One is the qualification and how people present themselves as the sort of prescriber of these products, and then the product itself. The Dash 1 amendment attempts to give the Board of Pharmacy authority to regulate the product. That's something that's been, as many of you may know, has been looked at for years at the federal level. You know, should the FDA regulate herbal products? And pretty consistently, Congress has said no, they don't have, they're not willing to give them that authority. And it leads to another concern of cost and the resources that the Board of Pharmacy, which I believe they're here to speak to the bill also, that they have. And with prescription drugs, there's not a dispute about what's in the package. Everything has a common identification number. It's been through testing at a national level, and there's not a dispute about that, and the Board of Pharmacy then regulates how that is then labeled when it's repackaged for the consumer. In this area, there can be fundamental disputes about what the product even is, which would lead us to believe that there would need to be some capacity for laboratory testing or a contract for that. I would suggest that it would take fairly substantial fees from the people who would be licensed if they were willing to cooperate in this regime, since they are not now cooperating in any form of licensure. They would be willing to do that, and so our concern would be the board get wrapped up in a labeling case or cases and really have the resources sucked dry from the board's other missions in regulating the practice of pharmacy and the distribution of drugs. Certainly willing to discuss how to approach this issue. It is a serious issue, worthy of consideration, maybe a good subject for some interim work to get into the technical detail.
Okay, thanks, Tom.
I just need to know, he complains when we leave the Board of Pharmacy out, and he complains when we put the Board of Pharmacy in. There's no satisfying Tom.
Gary Schnabel and Zweber, is it, with the Board of Pharmacy? And if I could ask you to make your comments very brief, I know you waited a long time, but we have to move on, and it seems to me that this bill has a lot of work ahead of it if it's going to be successful.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I will be brief. Gary Schnabel, Executive Director of the Board of Pharmacy. And I will say up front, the board has not taken a position on the bill. There was some brief discussion at its last meeting, and a general consensus was that it is a significant problem that has been identified, and we're not looking for more work. The board has a lot of stuff on its plate these days, but it probably is appropriate, or at least an appropriate agency to deal with this. It's what we do, sort of. We with traditional medications, the board and staff has a lot of experience with and understanding of traditional drug distribution. That's through easily identifiable regulated products, through easily identifiable regulated drug outlets, as Tom mentioned, and easily identifiable individuals who are licensed by the board. But the board has no experience with these particular products, so we don't know who sells them or how they're sold or whether they're in clinics or stores. So in trying to set a fiscal impact or talk about how much it's going to cost is really difficult for us to say. It's got a potential of being a big deal, but maybe not. We just don't know how many there are and what that would turn into. So we're not here to discourage the bill. It's a good idea, but we'd kind of like to know what we're getting into, and if we could clarify that by rule or if we could clarify with amendments or with interim work, as Tom said, the Board of Pharmacy will work with the committee however you want us to.
Representative Anderson, it's brief.
Thank you. Two questions. Is this something that could be put into legislation and enabled when funds are available?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I'm not sure if I can answer that. The bill does have a provision for the board to establish a fee and charge a fee for the registration, so there's a revenue source.
And do you think that those revenues would be adequate? I hear you.
Well,
Mr. Holt, yeah. Saying it might be a real strain on the department, on the board.
If we were able to, you know, make some determination about what we thought it would cost figure out what the fee would be and see if they were willing to pay the fee, then all we would need to do is convince DAS to let us have whatever staffing adjustments we'd have to do, because the revenue would be there. It may be a huge cost of a license, or may not, depending on what, you know, what the clarifications were.
I guess the basic question should precede is this an issue that the federal government should deal with rather than state government?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I'm not sure why I laughed. I guess we had that thought that, you know, we could do this in Oregon, but are they doing it in other? We don't know if they're doing it in other states. I know the federal government has looked at this. The federal government does have some regulatory efforts around dietary supplements, some labeling and some manufacturing requirements around, you know, what is defined as a dietary supplement. Without having done the research, we're not sure which of these products, if any, are actually dietary supplements and maybe have some labeling requirements already.
Mm-hmm.
But that's certainly a good question to ask, I think.
Okay, thanks very much. Anne, did you have something to add?
Yeah, I just wanted to say a few things. I brought visual aids. I have a little collection. I'm kind of into this. I like to explore alternative and herbal medicine, so I was going to pass this around, some of the things that you might find at a lot of different markets. And then I also have a textbook of Oriental Materia Medica, and it lists a lot of products that are used, so if you guys want to take a look at it.
Okay.
Thank you. But I need that back as a student. I'm a pharmacist, and I teach at the College of Pharmacy, and I have a little bit of an interest in this subject, and I'm also on the Board of Pharmacy. And when
state
I
your name also?
Oh, Ann Zweber.
Thanks.
Okay. When I first read the bill, I thought I could clearly see that there was a need for this, especially as you see the packages that go around. I do have concerns as a practitioner about the safety and the quality of these things. But I still would like to have, there's a couple of things that came to mind. I'd like to have more information about where these are being used and how they're being used and the extent of the problems that are in Oregon and actually around the country with this type of medicine. The other thing that comes to mind is like we talked about, not knowing where these are being dispensed, and I was kind of racking my brain thinking of all the different people that might dispense herbs, or any of the herbs that are in the compendia, for treatment of different illnesses. And it could be even like at the farmers markets where they sell different herbal teas, those would be included in this compendia. Anything in the grocery store, you'll see in that book, there's things like watermelon, cinnamon, let's see, what else do I have? Pumpkin seeds, nutmeg, they're all in the Oriental Pharmacopoeia. So it's a pretty broad task. A little bit.
You're about to lose your tea here.
Challenging. and like Gary said, you're not really quite sure exactly what's in there. So as a healthcare provider, I think this is a good idea. I'm not sure if this is where Oregon wants it to be. I think, as Representative Anderson stated, maybe it is more of a federal concern. I believe there's a lot of potential for drug interactions, for misuse, for just confusion about what patients are taking and how that affects their therapy and health. And I'd like to make sure that the people of Oregon are safe.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2672. We'll open the public hearing on House Bill 3029. Sandy, you'll get your stuff back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3029 is a bill
at the request of the Oregon Commission on Children and Families. It's requesting that the Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee be transferred from the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission to the State Commission on Children and Families. We have Representative March and Representative Woodson.
All right, gentlemen, come forward, please. Welcome. Thank you, Chair Dalto and members of the committee. We sat before you here, Representative Marsh and I, as people who work in the local Commission on Children and Families. So we wanted to.
You have to introduce yourself.
I'm sorry, there, Mr. Representative Gene Wisnett, District 53. Thank you for having us here today. Both Representative Marsh and I are here to testify in support of HB 3029 relating to the State Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee. As I said, Representative Marsh and I both have personal connections to the Commissions on Children and Family at the county level and strongly endorse the benefit of this bill. Oregon, or HB 3029 will transfer the Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee from the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission to the Oregon Commission on Children and Families. Governor Kulongoski included this proposed transfer in his governor's budget in order to put complementary efforts into one agency that focuses on prevention. Chair Dalto and members of the committee, I also serve on the Ways and Means Public Safety Committee, and we've talked about this because it's coming from the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. It was actually moved there from another agency, and we found in our testimony at the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission, they're not able to focus on their primary mission, which was a strategic planning mission, because of the different things like this that they've been added to their responsibilities. I think that you're going to hear from Executive Director Prinz today, and he can talk about that. I will not put words in his mouth, but his testimony to our subcommittee was that they're in favor of this, and it would give them more time to focus on their strategic planning commission of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. I'll let Representative Marsh talk about some of the things that the Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee focuses on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for hearing this bill. For the record, my name is Steve March. I represent House District 46 in the center of Portland. I am also serve on the Multnomah County Commission on Children, Family, and Communities, because they added communities in Multnomah County. The local commissions are in a large part responsible for planning around juvenile justice issues, and in particular addressing some of the high-risk problems that every community is facing, such as school failure, substance abuse, poor family functioning, negative peer association, antisocial behavior that are associated as precursors or as adjoining issues around juvenile crime. None of us were here in 1999 except for perhaps the committee administrator, when Senate Bill 555, I think it was 99, was passed. And that bill directed a lot of funding to go through local commissions and for programs in the communities, as each community saw fit to address their particular problems and looking at in their community. And that's why the Commission on Children and Families and in their local communities are so vital, in that they are the planning agency. They don't spend a lot of money for the commission. They take that money and direct it, target it at solutions to these problems of juvenile crime and other problems in the community. And I think it's a perfect fit to move this Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee to reside within the commission, the State Commission on Children and Family, Children and Families. So throwing an extra S in there. Children's already plural. Anyhow, so if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them or turn it back to Representative Wisnett.
Yes, Representative Boone.
Well, I just have a quick question about what's been going on in Ways and Means with the commission. How will this affect that?
Well, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Representative Boone, as you know, the co-chairs, Senate co-chair did not fund the Commission on Children and Families and asked that that be transferred to DHS. During our days on the road, Representative Marsh and I heard great testimony from people supporting the keeping the Commission for Children and Families as a separate agency, and I'm optimistic that the Senate co-chair heard those words and hopefully will retain the State Commission on Children and Families as a separate agency and not put it under DHS. And this would then and put that money back in the system too, because it was not the co-chair, the Senate co-chair deleted the money for I think it's $22 million for the Commission on Children and Families and $6.8 million for the juvenile crime prevention money. Hope that answers your
question. Yeah, thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appears to me that the Department of Human Services is a labyrinth, and I would worry a little bit that this advisory committee might get lost in that department, as opposed to the smaller and probably a little bit more efficient agency from which it's being taken. Do you have any comments on that?
I agree completely, and I think the real difference is I don't believe DHS has asked for it, but secondly, if you look at the mission of the Department of Human Services, they are a governmental focused organization. The Commission on Children and Families works with local community providers in many instances. The dollars that they direct out generally wind up in community-based organizations that help solve these problems. Some are used by the local governments for, where it's the appropriate use and targeted. Others go to community-based organizations to serve the youth and to help prevent juvenile justice issues.
Representative Boone.
Just a follow-up, too, is then if this bill should pass, but the commission shall go unfunded and under DHS, what happens with the money? Is it protected to stick with the newly housed commission, or what?
Mr. Chair, Representative Boone, we don't know. Now, again, I'm pretty optimistic that the Senate co-chair has heard enough testimony and been lobbied enough that he realizes that there is a value to the State Commission, and I'd be very surprised if the Senator or the Senate co-chair's proposal to move the Commission under DHS occurs. But your question is still good and valid. I don't, you know, it would still, I think, still would need to transfer in that function to the commission, no matter where it's located, but we're hoping that it's going to be located as a separate entity and serve the good people of Oregon, the children and families, like it has for many years.
Okay, thank you.
We're not adjourning this session without funding for the State Commission on Children and Families. I mean, that's as far as I'm concerned, as far as I know you're concerned, so I don't even think that's a possibility. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'll join you on the capital steps on that one, Billy.
Okay. Who should we go to next? Mickey Lansing. We're sort of running up against the clock, folks. So with that, welcome.
Thank you. I will be brief. Chair Dalto, members of the committee, my name is Mickey Lansing, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Commission on Children and Families, the current Oregon Commission on Children and Families. Back in November, we started discussions with Oregon Youth Authority and the Criminal Justice Commission. I'm not even going to go about off my written testimony to talk about these funds and how important they were on the what we call prevention continuum. The Commission on Children and Families funds prevention initiatives all along that continuum, 0 to 18 years of age. So do the juvenile crime prevention funds, especially as they relate to children 10 years of age and older. We have been working together in an initiative called Partners for Children and Families, where the Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee, the Commission on Children and Families, the Oregon Department of Education, the Oregon Youth Authority, and the Department of Human Services look at what is it that we each do? How do we work in communities? How do we support local communities to get the best kind of services that they are able to provide? And how do we do that in a way that we can break down barriers at the state level to better support their work locally? And so when we started these discussions and the governor talked about moving prevention dollars to the agency that really focuses on prevention, it seemed to make sense that they came to the commission as opposed to the Oregon Youth Authority. But we wanted you to know that we did have that discussion. The Oregon Youth Authority's mission is very different. Ours is about prevention, but all the work we do together fits and connects. So it was the decision of the governor to put these dollars in the Commission on Children and Families. Already, 18 of the local commissions out of 36 administer these funds. The other 18 counties, those funds are administered through the local juvenile department. They work very well together. They do their planning, but I want to go on record to say we are not planning. We are implementing. We have done the plan. That is over. But we are implementing what it is that communities need to support their youth. So it seems to make sense. There are many similarities. We believe those decisions at the local level are well made. That's where they need to stay. And as an added benefit, there also will be some cost savings, about 1.5 FTE plus some other dollar amounts by moving it from the Criminal Justice Commission to the Commission on Children and Families. When you ask the question, Representative Boone, what will happen, what you need to know is in the co-Senate co-chair's budget, it was not only $22 million of general fund being taken out of the commission and moving any other state functions to DHS, but it also eliminated all of the juvenile crime prevention funds. In the House budget, it retained both the state commission total funds and the juvenile crime prevention funds. So just to let you know that. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thanks, Mickey.
Thank you.
Larry Oglesby, Tammy Chatfield, and Ruth Hewitt, please. And it's my intention to pass this bill out today, so you can just tell us what a great idea this bill is, and we'll be on our way. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ruth Hewitt, and I'm the current chair of Marion County's Children and Families Commission. You have before you a letter signed for me on behalf of our commission and by our Board of Commissioner member, Janet Carlson, who also served in this legislative body. We're here in support of this bill and transferring the what you see there before you over. If you look at the second page of the handout, you have several coming. You also will see the continuum that was so eloquently spoken to by the people who appeared before you before me. We believe that what we've done in the planning for this on a community basis has been, at least in our case, very evidence-based. And I'd like to just point out two areas instead of going through a major testimony, that it isn't just that the commission, in partnership with others, plan, but in these instances, we have programs report back, we monitor, we have accountability, we talk about are they working, and if they aren't, you can change and alter them to make them fit the needs and the wishes of this legislative body that sent the money out in the first place for those. And you've heard a lot, people talk constantly about intervention and prevention for early children, but a wonderful part of this is that we can look at it as a intervention and kind of preventative measure for those older youth What the intent was to find a way to keep families whole and their children so that they didn't then move on into the Oregon Youth Authority and on into the correctional group, and I think we did a really nice job of that. So I'm going to end because I know there are many people wanting to testify, but and move to Larry Oglesby, who could really answer any specific questions. Thank you very much for letting me testify.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Larry Oglesby. I'm director of the Marion County Juvenile Department, a member of the Marion County Commission on Children and Families. Early in my career, the staff person to the Juvenile Services Commission, which was a predecessor agency of the Children and Family Commissions, and I was also a member of the original work group that developed the Juvenile Crime Prevention Partnership, which is the $6 million that was spoken to previously. My testimony, I think, pretty much speaks to the issues of why this bill should pass. There is a close relationship between commissions on children and families, juvenile departments. Many of our members, although I'm speaking as an individual today, of our association are members of children and family commissions. Some are directors of local commissions, and one of our juvenile directors is a director of a local commission and a member of the State Commission on Children and Families. So the relationship is important. Our plans are integrated into the 555 plan of the Children and Family Commission, the juvenile crime prevention portion of it. So that's the structural reasons why I think you should support the bill. I would be remiss if I didn't mention the $6 million. As you may know, that's 70% less than was available originally. It was a $28 million initiative that's been proven to work. And it was cut by about two-thirds last session. It's critical that these programs continue to be able to do the work we're doing, intervening with kids and families early on with the goal of keeping them out of the adult correction system, which is a lifelong cost to the taxpayers. That's our goal. That's what we've set out to do, and I think we've done that very well. One quick example. In our family support program in Marion County, of 300 families that we have worked with, of kids aged 10 to 12, the very high-risk kids, highest-risk families, two-thirds of those have met all of their goals and have been moving on into more productive lives and staying out of the justice systems, which would be a different result if we were not doing that. So I would urge you to support this bill and also to support the funding for the juvenile crime prevention plans. Thank you.
Good morning, excuse me, Chair Dalto and committee members. My name is Tammy Chatfield, and I'm with the Salem Leadership Foundation, and our organization has a strong partnership with the Children and Families Commission. And I would just like to say that we are totally in support of this Senate bill in switching this over to the commission. It is just really crucial that at the local level that these partnerships continue, and the commission has been very instrumental in bringing a lot of us community partners together for all of us to work on the children and family issues that we have in our county. And they have also been very instrumental in bringing in the faith community, which our organization is a faith organization, and they have proven that with their efforts that they support best practices and that they engage and mobilize many of us community partners and bring us all around the table to work on these issues together. And it has been a proven effort that we are making a difference here in this community. So we support what they do with the little that they receive. They are able to accomplish a lot, especially with bringing in all the community together to work. So we support that. We support them and this bill.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much. Larry, could I ask you to do me a favor and get some information for this committee on the juvenile crime prevention plan money? Just we don't do a whole lot of budgets here, and I'd like to learn a little more about it.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman, we'll be happy to do that.
Okay. Thanks. Kate Cooper Richardson and Ms. Odell. I can't really read that. I'm sorry?
Lona.
L-O-N-A, Lona. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. First, I want to make very clear that the Treasurer's Office is not here today. I'm here in my private capacity. I actually do have a life outside of the Treasurer's Office, and in that life, I'm a member of the Polk County Commission on Children and Families. I'm also the chair of the statewide coalition of all the local commissions for children and families of all 36 counties. And I just wanted to get on the record today that our coalition of 36 Commission Children and Families County, the county commissions are in support of this bill. It's a good bill. Should pass.
Did you state your name?
Well, you did for me. I'm Ms. Kate Cooper Richardson, and I'm the chair of the statewide coalition of county children and family commissions.
They grabbed the name with the tape so that, you know, 30 years from now, if anybody bothered to listen to Representative Anderson's comments today, they could know who's speaking. That's a joke, Representative Anderson. Lona.
So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lona Odell. I am the manager for the Polk County Commission for Children and Families, and Kate and I are simply here together to state our support. I'm a member of the local coalition of commissions for children and families. There are 36 counties are members of that group, and actually Randy Franke does the representation for us for that group. He's out of state today and asked us to come and share the position in support of the bill for the local coalition.
Okay. Thank you very much. Excellent. Short and sweet.
I was hoping when we saw Kate that she would just be offering to bring the money.
We're printing it right
now. Printing it right now, right?
Craig, you've been waiting 60 minutes, but you got 60 seconds.
Mr. Chairman, Craig Prinz, Criminal Justice's Executive Director. I just wanted to let you know that I support this bill. I think it makes a lot of sense for as far as the mission of the JCPAC. I think you've heard mostly about the Commission on Children and Families, but the move of the JCPAC to the Commission on Children and Families, I think, makes a lot of sense as far as its mission. As Representative Wisnett said, I think it makes sense to allow the Criminal Justice Commission to focus on the criminal justice system itself and not this prevention portion. And lastly, I think you're getting some great employees that work at the Criminal Justice Commission have done a really good job of working with this advisory committee. I'll be very sad to see them go, but I think it's a good fit with where they're going, and I hope that that there'll be a commission to go to. So with that, I'll if there's any questions. If not, that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Record time. Thank you very much. Okay, with that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3029, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 29. This bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Did I say 3029?
I thought you just said 29.
3029. Thanks very much. There is a subsequent referral, so I'd like a motion, please, to move this to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair.
That's Representative Tony.
I move House Bill 3029 to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you very much, Representative Tomei. Representative Tomei moves House Bill 3029 to the full Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection?
Chair Belter, just discussion. I just wanted to state I was on the Juvenile Big Act in 1987 to 89, and at the time thought this would be a great thing to move into prevention. So here it is.
Excellent. So you saw it many years ago. And all right, without objection, House Bill 3029 is ordered to the full Committee on Ways and Means. We don't need a roll.
Mr. Chair, just to highlight and enter into the record, we did get testimony from Janet Carlson from the Marion County Commissioner and Commissioner's Office in support of the bill. That will be entered into the record in support of.
Okay. Thank you very much. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3029 and open a work session on House Bill 2202. This is the bill that deals with runaway and homeless youth, and I'll ask Gene Lassiter and Galen Phipps forward, please. Well, I wanted to move this bill out today, but it sounds like there's some work that needs to be done. So where are we at?
Well, we have... Chair Dalto, my name is Galen Phipps. I'm the chair of the Oregon Homeless and Runaway Youth Coalition. Committee members. We have We have met with Representative Boone, Representative Butler, and gotten their advice about changes to the original concept of House Bill 2202. And we have submitted some recommendations for revisions, and they should be in front of you. Our purpose is to be responsive to the needs of local commissions as they identify runaway and homeless youth and families as issues of need in local communities around the state. The Partners for Children and Families are on board with taking a lead role in coordinating statewide efforts around removing barriers to local communities. The Oregon Department of Education was left out of the original bill, and they are very interested in participating, and that was an oversight of the original bill, and it has been inserted in the language. And there has been considerable momentum around this issue statewide, not only statewide, but in this federal region in the United States as well. The federal office in Seattle is interested in seeing if the efforts that we're doing here in Oregon can be replicated in Idaho, Alaska, and Washington. In addition to that, there's a Senate bill 1048 that is a companion bill to this one. Sets up an interagency council on hunger, which is currently in existence, with an interagency council on homelessness. And part of that, part of those, the members that are involved in that is homeless and runaway youth. Homeless and runaway youth being the prevention end of the statewide homeless issue that council is dealing with. So we are planning on doing the front-end research from the county base, and our recommendations will then be integrated into the long-term state plan around homeless issues with the Interagency Council on Hunger and Homelessness. So we're working together with them to do this work on the local level, have it integrated into the statewide planning, and then move this along and get something going for this underserved population in the state.
Great.
And with that, I'll leave to Jean to talk about the specific changes that that we made.
Good morning, Chair Dalto, members of the committee. I'm Jean Lassiter, and I live and work here in Salem, and I'm here representing the Oregon the Oregon Homeless and Runaway Youth Coalition. As Galen mentioned, we were very diligent, I think, in addressing some of the concerns that were brought up by Representative Butler with regard to the original House Bill 2202. So, as Galen mentioned, we met with Representative Butler, we met and Randy Franke and Representative Boone to address those issues. What we then did was construct an alternate version or an amended version of House Bill 2202 and sent that along to the committee administrator, and that's where we are with this process. So I apologize for not knowing where else to go with that, but that's where we are.
Okay. All right, so let me just clarify this. You've done your due diligence. You've worked with Representative Butler. You've worked with the parties that were concerned initially. You've worked through those issues, resolved those issues. Doesn't sound like anybody's objecting to this bill. You have some amendments. We have them in legislative council to be drafted. As soon as we get those, this bill is ready to go. And there's a piece of companion legislation. So, Sandy, let's put this bill back up on May 2nd on our work session day. You can be here. You don't have to be here, but we're going to work it out on May 2nd as soon as we get the amendments. So you might like to be here to see it work out. Representative May, did you have
one? No, I didn't.
Okay. Is there any discussion?
I just want to add that Dean and Galen, we all met at 6 o'clock at Tom Butler's, in Rep Butler's
at
office.
6 a.m.
6 a.m. or whatever.
Yeah, we had to come in through the garage because there wasn't any.
It was quite, but it was a good meeting, and I feel very confident that we addressed. I'm sorry that Rep Butler's not here just to make sure, but I'm sure. I was sure at that meeting, and they did everything in record time with and Randy with mm-hmm. Star and all this. So I think it's coming together really well, and I can't wait for it to get out of here.
Chair Dalto and members of the committee, I just want to say that we intentionally revised the language of the bill just for your edification. I think you probably have a copy of my version, which has my notes on it, so actually you'll know what changes we made. But as Galen mentioned, we included Department of Education, which was an oversight in the original bill. We shifted the language in response to Representative Butler's concern because, you know, I think that, you know, our perception of his objections, and he can certainly name those, was that this was a kind of a top-down process to establish policies that would impact local communities. And so we were attentive to that, and we really were intentional in revising the language of the bill so it really presents itself as an intentional way to work with local communities, but work on the state level with many agencies to address the needs of this population comprehensively. And that's kind of where the direction we came from, so we're hopeful that that will in fact be satisfactory. And Mickey Lansing is the chair of the Partners for Children and Families, and in response to a request from us to really bring this, and Representative Butler, to bring this to their attention and get a feeling for whether they really thought this was their issue or not, she did convene that group or brought it up in an existing meeting, and they did say that this is well within their purview and they're willing to keep this and take it on.
Excellent. Great job. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
With that, we will close the public hearing. We'll close the work session.
Not yet, sir. Okay. I just want to acknowledge also, we have written testimony submitted from the League of Women Voters of Oregon in support of the bill, again from the Marion County Commissioner Janet Carlson, and the League of another submission from the League of Women Voters. This one is from Robin Wisdom, for the record.
Okay, and it looks like we just received testimony from Janet Ahrens and the Oregon Alliance of Children Advocacy, and we'll pass that out to you. With that, we will close the work session on House Bill 2202. And, colleagues, we did receive some written testimony from the Department of Human Services and Gail Shibley on House Bill 3311, which was the lead poisoning education bill. So I'm going to pass that out. It looked like there were some concerns in that testimony, so you may want to read through that. With that, seeing no other business coming before the committee, we are adjourned. Thanks.
Is this for me?
Yes, that was your question.
Thank you. Okay, don't go into...
I got a thing.
Yeah.
Nice job. Good job. Sorry to keep you waiting so long.
Thank you.
Sorry to keep waiting. You have to pick who's going to wait for the whole time. It's either you or the OPI folks.
Thanks,
Gordy.
Okay, did I
get you? No, you didn't give me any.
Okay,
that's 3311.
Thank you, Carol. You're welcome, Billy. Thank you. Good meeting.
All right.
I think I got 2202 already.
It's a child advocate.
Yeah, I got this one.
They're doing a good job now. I told you.
17 kids in
a little while.
Oh, you mean on your espresso?
On my mocha.
Just have to take your shirt off and sell the whiplash.
What's been going on, but trying to make this even better.
It always tastes the same now. You know, exactly what you want.
Oh, my wife.
Great job. Really appreciate it.
And I will probably, I think she's coming home this weekend. I have to email her right now. Ask her when, because I'm hoping I don't have to go pick her up, because
I have to go down to Corvallis on Saturday really quick, but I will.
Just take your time.
First of the week, I'm guessing.
Okay. It's no hurry. I just want to let you know.
Okay. That's great. She will be very happy. Okay. She can reclaim that spot, you know, in her garage. So.
It's okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Jean.
Cell phone on a chair. Yeah. I don't know. They might have. I mean, our loss of
Mickey and
out of the chaos. Yeah. Okay.